This is Growing the Valley, a podcast by the University of California, Agriculture and Natural Resources. I'm one of your hosts, Luke Melliron, Farm Advisor for Butte, Tehama, and Glenn Counties.
I'm your other host, Phoebe Gordon, Orchard Farm Advisor for Madera and Merced Counties. Speaking with James Schaefer, who is a former master's student at Fresno State, and he now works for Helena Chemical. And he did some work on alkali weed with Anil Shrestha, a long-term employee of Kurt Hembree, who is our weed advisor for Fresno County. So James has a lot of experience with weeds. So welcome to the podcast, James.
Thank you, Phoebe. Nice to see you. Nice to talk to you.
Full disclosure, we're recording this on Zoom. Let's go over some of the work you did with alkali weed. We did a brief update on this new weed species. Well, it's not a new weed species, but it's new weed to ag back in late 2018. But there's been some more research that's been done, and so we understand a little bit more about it now. What sort of research did you do looking into alkali weed?
Okay, well, first of all, alkali weed is a native plant to California, so it's, you know, a tricky thing to call it a weed. The Native Plant Society doesn't really like that, but by definition, it is a weed. It's a plant growing in an unwanted area, so that's kind of why we refer to it in that light. So for my master's work, my thesis work at Fresno State with Dr. Shrestha and Kurt Hembree, we looked at seed germination rates and treatments of salinity, treatments of pH, and different treatments of water potential. Then we also looked at shade intolerance using shade cloth on built frames in the field. The seed treatment experiments were conducted at the Fresno State Jordan Agricultural Research Center, and these were all done 2019. The shade cloth treatment went from beginning of March through August of 2019, and the seed treatments, seed germination studies were done in June and July of 2019 on Fresno State campus.
All right, let's start off with the seed germination. Does the weed have the name alkali weed for a reason?
Well, you know, we're noticing it in a lot of new young pistachio orchards, which are being planted in what used to be agronomic ground, cotton ground, tomato ground. So it's very saline sodic soils. You know, you can't grow a lot of crops in these heavy soils. And from what we're seeing is in these specific fields, alkali weed tends to be a monoculture. So it's the only weed present in these fields. And we're seeing this plant in these fields as opposed to fields with better soil properties and better soil qualities. So what we think is that it tends to like these saline sodic grounds more so than your nicer farming ground. With the seed germination experiments, what we determined was that alkali weed germinated across a wide variety of pHs, EC levels. So we know the plant is fairly drought tolerant, and also that this plant is unbiased when it comes to pHs and salinity in the field. You know, it germinated in all the ranges, but we tend to see it in the field at the high salinity levels.
What ranges of pH and EC were you looking at?
So pH, we looked at a range of 5 up to 9, and there was no significant differences. We germinated 100 seeds per treatment, and the experiment was replicated twice, and the results were similar in both experiments. And then our range of salinity, we looked at an EC of 0 up to 20 decisiemens.
Wow.
And yeah, we had germination until 16 decisiemens. So over 50% of the plants germinated up to 16 decisiemens. And then after that, we still had germination, but it was a lot lower.
Okay. Those are really high ACs.
Yeah.
And just to, I guess, give a little background you know, high pH and high EC do tend to be connected with each other in the field, correct?
That's when I refer to these saline sodic soils. You know, a lot of two of the ranches where we're doing some of our studies or we've looked at this problem, we've seen pH of right around 8 and then an EC of about 12.
So we've established that alkali weed can germinate in conditions that most plants can't really survive in at all. And when seeds are germinating, they tend to be much more sensitive to adverse conditions, correct?
Correct. You know, the interesting thing about alkali weed is in these fields, in these roadsides where we've documented these populations, we've seen the plants flower, but we've never actually seen any plants set seed, nor have we found seedlings or small plants. All these fields and roadsides have been either treated with a herbicide, disced, or scraped using cultivation practices. So this, you know, led to other questions which may perpetuate future research into looking at the underground growing structures of the plant. So we tend to believe that alkali weed is also moving through its underground shoot root structures.
Alkali weed is related to bindweed, correct?
Yeah, so alkali weed is a member of the Convolvulaceae family. So it's, you know, a cousin to field bindweed. That is considered the morning glory family. And it's also a close cousin to dodder, which was a problem in Fresno County several years ago. And those are just some examples of very problematic weeds. So, you know, you can just kind of assume that something related to that might be problematic as well. And that's what we're capturing in the field.
Do we have much of an idea of what alkali weed roots look like?
Well, first of all, what prompted this research that I started was there was no information out there. We did an extensive literature review and there's only, you know, anecdotal notes of alkali weed mentioned in other studies in different types of areas, salt marshes, desert plains and stuff like that. But there's no research literature on this plant. So this prompted me to start some initial research just so we could get more familiar with the plant. With that being said, in some of these roadside sites, I've dug out the side of these canal banks and these roadside and followed single shoots down, you know, 18 to 24 inches where they tee off and send a lateral root or shoot, move sideways through these tough soils, which is, you know, a feat in itself, and then push new growth upward from 18 inches below the ground and break the surface and produce a new plant.
All right. So moving on to your shade and tolerance work. What can you tell us about that?
So the reason the shade intolerance study started was because the only piece of literature that we found from a website stated that alkali weed was shade intolerant. And, you know, there wasn't any information to back that up. What we had noticed was that this plant was growing vigorously in young orchards where there wasn't a lot of shade, and we didn't really see it in any older, more established orchards. So what we did was we created three treatments, a 70% sunlight, a 30% sunlight, and a full sunlight treatment, and set up shade cloths out in an open field with a known alkali weed population consistent. And we put these shade cloths up, monitored the growth of the plants from first emergence through flowering. And results from that shade study were pretty interesting. I think the biggest take home was that in the full sunlight, these plants produced flowers and ultimately seed. In the 30% and in the 70% shaded trials, we produced no flowers, which may lend itself to some management strategies or just, you know, an idea of how this plant works. Other than that, internode length was significantly different from the full sunlight to the 30% and 70% shade. Internodes were longer, plants were more spindly, leaves were flatter, more surface area, and they tended to look like there was less leaf hairs on the shaded plants. You know, they were definitely trying to find that sun under those shade canopies.
Those are interesting observations because those tend to be physiological changes that plants will go through when adapting to shade as well. So how long did you follow these plants under the shade?
So we followed them from first emergence, which was in March, and we followed those through flowering, which, as I mentioned earlier, we didn't find any flowers on our on the shade treatments that actually provided shade, the 30 and the 70%. So we monitored the flowers in the full sunlight. We harvested those, and then we gave the shaded plants a little more time, and no flowers were produced. So we called that experiment. Also, just a note, in the two shaded treatments, the 30 and 70% shade, there was a significant difference in total leaf area. Leaves were wider, flatter, and a little bit bigger as compared to the full sunlight that they maintained their small, short, stout leaves. And just for your listeners, you know, this plant only grows about 8 to 10 inches tall. It's a herbaceous shrub, so it's not a real big, robust plant. It's kind of a light silvery green with lots of leaf hairs on it, and it produces real small white flowers on the stems May through September.
Do you have any experience with trying to control it?
Yes. We have documented a few of our preliminary herbicide trials, as well as noting what growers are using in the field. And we have looked at 7 different modes of action in the herbicide world, and every single treatment has resulted the same. We see a burn down, necrosis or chlorosis, and within 3 to 4 weeks, we see new green material growing from the growing point, which is right there at the surface, or, you know, an inch below the surface. What we notice is the plants die down to this main growing point that stops right where the root or shoot takes off below ground. And so you'll see dead plant material right around this growing surface, and then you'll see a new shoot pop up right next to it. So you'll get these clumps right at the growing point under the surface of where this plant material died, and then you'll get new growth. And then also, when the plant goes dormant in the winter, when we see new growth in the early spring, that dead material dries off and falls off, and then that main growing point, just that clump, will push out new growth there as well. So I think what we're thinking is, you know, we don't know how much of this herbicide is actually translocating, you know, from a systemic herbicide standpoint, into the roots and moving through the plant. It may be being sequestered or stored somewhere else within the plant, or we may not be getting just good movement through the plant at all.
Is there any work that's been done to show loss in yield or growth from having a severe alkali weed infestation?
No, and that's a great point. You know, when we talk to growers and PCAs, primarily they don't like alkali weed from an aesthetic point of view. It makes their field look, you know, a little trashy and ugly, and we understand that. Definitely research needs to be done to somehow quantify any sort of loss or competition between these young trees and the alkali weed, whether it be water or nutrients within the ground. And actually, Dr. Delruba Yeisman from Fresno State, in conjunction with Dr. Bushhoven, they're trying to get funding to use ground penetrating radar to somehow quantify the amount of roots of the alkali weed in these big patches within a pistachio orchard, to see if they can use that information to do some future work in quantifying competition. We just don't know if it's affecting the trees in any sort of way.
Yeah, if you can't kill it, it'd be good to know if it should actually affect the trees.
Yep, and you know, Kurt Hembray and I had often joked around about, you know, alkali weed would be a great, as a source to, you know, mitigate erosion on hillsides, roadsides, and, you know, we're also not sure if the plant's even palatable to animals. You know, maybe goats or sheep or some sort of livestock is an option in taking these populations down. I think the general consensus is we need to learn more about the underground structures and, you know, how those are working. I don't know if it's part of the defense of the plant, but the roots tend to, or shoots rather, tend to break easily. And that may be a part of the plant spreading, its propagation. You know, we've seen these fields where, like I said, they're being treated and the plants don't end up going to flower, but in these young orchards, they're still doing 2 to 3, you know, disking cultivation events down the middles a year, and it might be spreading this plant further into the field. We just don't know.
Thanks for listening to Growing the Valley, a UCANR podcast. You can find out more about this episode at our website, growingthevalleypodcast.com.
We'd like to thank the Almond, Pistachio, Walnut, and Prune boards for their support. We'd also like to thank my sister, Muriel Gordon, for writing and recording the theme music.